Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social, or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals, and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
Hello, Felicity. So for once, we're both in our home offices, not in airports, hotels, or halfway across the world.
Which is unusual for us. Mm. Although, funnily enough, this episode started when I was back in Australia in September, and I was there for family reasons. And there's a long story behind this, but it ended in me helping to clear a liquor cabinet that had been quietly gathering dust for 20 years.
Ah, yes. So the archaeological dig of our drinks cupboards, eh? So we've got a genius solution coming later as to what we can all do with our vast array of forgotten and half-drunk bottles.
Yes, we do. And I have to give Luli full credit for this. This is a brilliant idea from her. And anyway, so what was inside the drinks cupboard I was clearing out? I found relics, including unopened gift boxes, half-drunk bottles of sherry, and a limoncello that had somehow outlived a family of limoncello drinkers.
Okay, so Felicity, do you know what the story was behind any of those?
I'm sorry to say I do. The unopened gift box of Canadian ice wine was actually the one that I had brought to dinner back in 2005.
So a gift not as appreciated as you had of thought. So did you finally open it? Was that any good?
I'm sorry to tell you that it's back in the cupboard, which now has the same number of bottles, but less dust.
What? So you didn't drink anything that you'd cleared out. You cleared out the cupboard, but you didn't clear it out because you put it all back.
Oh, I did. I did try a few of them and discovered why they had lain there for 20 years. Mm. But yes, I decided, so I know it's weird to actually just dust them off, try them and then put them straight back.
Yes.
But I decided to, get something out of it. And I wrote a LinkedIn post asking, what's lurking in the back of your drinks cupboard?
Which is the question for today's episode, and which, can I say, could be seen as a little bit of a cheat, because normally the questions come from our listeners, Felicity, not from you.
Yeah, it's true, but this turned out to be a fantastic idea, because it turns out that everybody's got a confession. I got dozens of answers, and some of them were hilarious.
Okay, so along with potentially cheating by asking the question yourself, you have also moved into my world of primary data collection, so you're really going for it this week, Felicity.
Now, just to remind everybody, this podcast is a shared endeavour with shared knowledge. It's a joint enterprise.
Okay, so fair enough. But before we dive in, a quick caveat from my side as our data maven, as you call me in the past. So the data we're going to talk about isn't representative in the strict sense. I feel like I'm doing a bit of a public service broadcast announcement.
Yes,
now.
This is true. So a lot of the answers came from people who work in the drinks industry who might be more bottle heavy than average. But the behaviours that they exhibit, hoarding, forgetting, re-gifting, all the things we're going to talk about, they're universal.
Yeah, they are. And as we're going to discover more. So once we've discovered what is actually lurking in our drinks cupboards, we're going to discuss the key psychological effects that lie behind them, not only why we have these drinks in the first place, but also, and perhaps more importantly, to your case in point, why we hang on to them and don't get rid of them.
Yes, I must admit, I'm a case study in this.
You are. So Felicity, we'll talk about our solutions as to what we can do with the plethora of unopened and half-drunk bottles. And as I said, I've got a plan.
Yes, and this is the highlight of the episode. Do you want to reveal your plan early?
Okay, so it's genius. Well, anyway, I think it's genius. So, ready? We're going to start a new festival, Felicity.
Yes, a festival. Go on.
Okay, so we're going to launch a new festival, and it's called the Festival of the Drinks Cabinet.
I think this is absolutely brilliant. But before we delve into the reason why we hoard our old bottles of drinks and you explain why the Festival of the Drinks Cabinet is indeed a genius solution, let's just touch on what we discovered in terms of what's actually lurking in people's drinks cupboards.
Yes, and seeing as you've stolen my thunder as your new resident primary researcher, why don't you kick off?
Okay, so the patterns were fascinating and they were occasionally horrifying.
Oh, okay, so we should also include that the feedback included lots of pictures And it even spurred one respondent to empty out their whole drinks cupboard and show us in picture proof and have a clear out.
That's right. And in many of the pictures shared from the drinks collection, and I should say that they were pretty much spirits rather than anything else, they ranged from typically 4 or 5 bottles to sometimes 30 or 40. And some of them had been sitting there for decades.
They had. So go on, start us off. What were the worst offenders?
So the top of the list were sweet liqueurs. Mm. Nearly half of those responded said they had one of these in the cupboard. So Bailey's, Advocaat, we had a banana liqueur, and we had also lots of peppermint drinks. Peppermint schnapps, or more regularly, Crème de Menthe.
Okay, so of that list, banana liqueur is a new one to me. So I have so many questions and thoughts about that. But I suppose these are kind of like the novelty singles, so that ages me, of the drinks world. Anyway, everyone owned them once and no one wants to admit it now.
Yes, the banana liqueur was actually a souvenir of a holiday. But before we talk about, and that's the story of many of these, but before we talk about collecting and obsession and hoarding and so on, I need to take us down a detour into minty drinks, the category of drinks that I loathe the most in the world.
Okay, I'll let your detour continue, but why? What's your reason?
So I have a terrible memory that I need to exercise.
Okay, well, I'm not sure that we should let you traumatise our listeners with whatever story you're about to tell.
No, we absolutely have to. So really? It's too late. So here goes. So when I was a teenager, I stayed at a girlfriend's place and her parents were foolish enough to go away for the weekend and leave us alone.
Okay, I suspect I know where this is going, and it tells us why probably the reason we have helicopter parenting today.
That's right. So her parents had this really well-stocked bar and we decided we were going to try alcohol for the first time. So we got a glass and we tipped in a little bit from each bottle so that they wouldn't notice the levels had gone down.
Okay, so bad, big mistake.
Yeah, it was. It was. So the final bottle was Crème de Menthe, which overpowered everything in the glass. It just tasted of Crème de Menthe and mint.
So I take it you didn't enjoy the taste.
Well, I literally can't remember. All I know is that when I woke up the next morning, I was covered in bruises because my friend had dragged me to bed. And when I got caught on the furniture, she kicked me out of the way.
You do know that's probably not necessarily the fault of the Crème de Menthe, but of the overall level and mix of alcohol in the glass.
No, it was definitely the Crème de Menthe. And I even smell it today, many years later, I retch. Mm. And judging from our responses, I'm not the only person who thinks that way.
Okay. So is this where I confess I had a very similar tequila incident story from my past?
Yeah, didn't we have a different upbringing from kids today? So tell me about the tequila incident.
No, I'm not going to share the details. Suffice to say, 40 years later, I've now re-engaged with tequila and actually particularly mezcal in a positive way, and I'm really enjoying it. Anyway, enough of that. So back to our responses to your question. We had, as we said, so many answers, which also included the minty drink options. You were saying that there people were talking about them. Can you remind me what they were saying?
Yeah, so I got one from Mary, who's a friend of mine in America, and she said, and this is in relation to Crème de Menthe, quote, "I have a bottle that must be more than 30 years old and it has maybe 2 tablespoons gone. I must have had a sweets recipe that called for it. Vile stuff." Okay, so you're the cocktail expert on this podcast. What sort of recipe might Mary have been using it for?
Okay, well, I'm not quite sure you can call WSET level one in spirits qualifying me as a cocktail expert, but I don't know if she was using it for cooking, but most famously it's used in cocktails like the Stinger, which is brandy and white Crème de Menthe, or the Grasshopper, which is the green Crème de Menthe, crème de cacao and cream. But these cocktails fell out of fashion in the mid-20th century or so.
Now, this, I'm sorry to say, was not my doing. Do you know why it happened?
Okay, yeah. So the bright green colour, which was once the selling point, by the 1970s, people were turning against very artificial colours and preferring more kind of natural browns and clears like whiskey and vodka. And I should add that if anyone is interested in why colour is so important in drinks, we covered it in our last episode, so give it a listen.
All right, one more quick detour. Cream liqueurs. I actually love Bailey's. And I know that other people do as well. I even saw a very famous wine critic pour himself a giant glass once in an airline lounge.
Okay, you're going to name names?
No. His secret is safe with me.
Oh, Felicity. Well, I guess that makes sense because many people in our responses admitted that they had bottles of Bailey's hiding in their cupboards as well.
Which I find totally baffling because I would have finished it if it was Bailey's, that is. So, but cream liqueurs are actually quite new. They've only been around for about 50, commercial cream liqueurs. People have made stuff at home, but they're only about 50 years old.
Yeah, well, Bailey's actually is one of my favourite kind of origin stories, really, of drinks. So back in 1973, David Gluckman, who incidentally had worked for the Irish Butter Board previously, was handed probably the vaguest brief imaginable in drinks, which is make something Irish.
Oh, right. And so it was his first thought, shamrocks and leprechauns?
No, a little bit more sophisticated than that. So he and his colleague, Hume Seymour Davis, ran down to the local supermarket, or so he tells in the story, bought a bottle of Jameson's Irish whiskey and some cream and started mixing in their office. So their first attempt, he said, was terrible. So they added sugar and cocoa and kind of kept tweaking it. And he says in under an hour, they had the prototype for Bailey's.
I wonder if that means I could do it myself at home. But anyway, please tell me that they needed a proper sample bottle ready for the client.
Nope. So he says that they poured the mixture into a rinsed out Schweppes bottle and pitched it like that. And as for the name, they lifted it from a bistro called Bailey's, which was next to the office, next to their office, which he kind of noticed when they were in this process.
Oh, funny. So David is still very active on social media and he's got a book called That Shit Will Never Sell. And in it, he said the first focus groups thought Bailey was a joke. They dismissed it as a girly drink and doubted it would sell. But within a year of its 1974 launch, it was flying. And today, it's the world's best-selling liqueur. So I know why I like it, but what does the market say about why it worked so well?
Okay, well, aside from the powerhouse marketing team weight behind it at Diageo, and to your point, the kind of flavour profile, which has strong broad appeal, you and the wine critic, Anonymous, as he I think you said, will remain, there's a behavioural science explanation too. So Bailey's kind of hits the sweet spot, if you'll excuse the pun, of category fusion, you will. So it combines two things consumers already knew and trusted, so whiskey and cream, into something novel, but not too alien. So psychologists call this the sort of optimal newness. So too familiar and it's boring, too strange and it's rejected. So Bailey's was right in the middle, new enough to feel excited, but anchored in comfort.
And I should say they did something else that was really important, which is they introduced food emulsifiers that kept it shelf stable for 2 years. Because one of our respondents had actually written to me about an Irish cream whiskey that they'd tried that wasn't Bailey's, and it had gone off and it made the drinkers extremely sick. She wrote me graphic details that were pretty much in line with my Comme des Montes experience.
Yes, I was about to say, it reminds me of that story. But anyway, let's move on from this, shall we? Yes. So back to, please, but back to what people confess to having in their drinks cupboard. So is now a good time, a good moment to mention our old friend Advocaat and all the Advocaat entries that
we had? I think we must mention Advocaat, yes.
Okay, yeah. So we had a fair few people who reported finding unloved bottles of Advocaat in their cupboards. And one correspondent, Paul Hewings, wrote, we have a bottle of Advocaat that never got opened but passed between friends. Whoever hosted the last party gifted the bottle to the people who host the next party and so on.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
Yeah, so there's more. So he added, no idea who bought it. No one would admit to it. But I think it started as trying to ditch the bottle and then it became a talisman. So full admission here, Felicity. I don't know the origins of Africa. I've never thought about it.
I'm now an expert because after I read some of the stories, I looked it up.
So that's handy.
Originally a Dutch drink that goes back to at least the 17th century. And there's a story that I couldn't verify that the first versions were made with avocados from the Dutch colonies, hence the name. But when they came back to Europe, of course, they didn't have avocados. So they swapped them for egg yolks to get that same thick, creamy texture. So it was an improvisation.
Okay. So which is how we end up with a drink that's basically kind of alcoholic custard-ish now.
Yeah, and so Advocaat became popular again after the Second World War, largely because, again, new technology meant it could be made shelf stable.
Oh, okay.
So producers like Warnick's industrialises and it was sold as a genteel drink for women.
Oh.
Most famously, it became the base of the Snowball cocktail. Advocaat, lemonade and a dash of lime.
Ah, yes. Being a child of the 70s, I do remember that being served. Clearly not to me. That would have been weird. But the Snowball, the 1970s Christmas party drink. So even if you weren't sipping it neat off a spoon, it was still thick, heavy and very sweet. And by the 1980s, kind of had been seen as dated or had become dated.
Yeah. So here's a fun fact I found. Under EU regulations, Advocaat has to have at least 140 grams of sugar per litre.
What? That's huge.
It is. It's about 35 teaspoons of sugar compared to 26 teaspoons in the same amount of Coke.
Oh, okay, so definitely best passed around or repurposed at a party. So can we move on from avocado to a section of the drinks cupboard then that I'm a big fan of, whiskies. So about a quarter of the people that responded to us had them, single malts, vintage, bourbons, Dalwhinnies, someone's uncle had given them, for example.
That's right. And these actually seem to be bottles that people were really proud of that they actually collect. They get opened, but they hardly ever get finished because they're tied to connoisseurship.
Okay, so admission here. So we have what we very grandly call, it is a grand name, our whiskey bar in our house. But bigger admission is that it's effectively 5 to 8 bottles at any one time.
What?
But we drink them all. Well, clearly not all at the same time, but we drink them until they're finished and then replace them sometimes with the same or sometimes with something different.
God, I'm going to pop round to your house sometime near Christmas. So firstly, so I can see all your drinks decorations on your tree. And secondly, so I can see your whiskey bar, because I didn't have you down as a big whiskey drinker, Luli.
I am a very big whiskey drinker. I love it. Big, peaty, smoky whiskey, absolutely mine. So along with the whiskey entries, we also had plenty of reports of brandy, Armagnac, Calvados, South African brandy. So about 1 in 5 were showing us or talking about brandy in their collections. And these felt, in the way that the respondents were talking about them, more like heritage bottles. So you kind of bring them out for Christmas or after a big family meal, sort of the smell of nostalgia as much as alcohol.
Yes, even my non-drinking sister has Tanunda brandy for Christmas in the cupboard. Okay, yeah. So gin and vodka also show up in about 20% of cabinets. Cotswold gin, we had an Icelandic gin, we had endless vodkas. But the difference, which was really interesting, is nobody confessed to feeling guilty about keeping these, because these are staples. Obviously, people know that they'll get around to them eventually.
Yeah, so we could think of gin and vodka sort of like rice and pasta, you know, that you just wait until you need them and they're sitting there in the cupboard. So what else did people report having?
What a great analogy. Okay, so although we're primarily talking about seeing spirits, there was some wine and fortifieds. About a fifth had bottles of sherry, muscat, Moet turned up a lot, or half-drunk whites. And these tended to be relegated to cooking or sentimentality, you know, as in this was from a friend's vineyard.
Okay. So were there any other really weird ones in there?
Indeed. Although we have to say they're probably not exotic to the people who made them. Okay. So about 15% confessed to national, what we might call curiosities. Mm-hmm. There was quince brandy from Bosnia, Moldovan Divan, a Mexican Dama Juana, if I pronounce that correctly, old monk rum from India. And these bottles really aren't meant to be drunk. They're souvenirs.
Which makes every cabinet sort of part bar, part museum. So you've got your staples, your skeletons that we've talked about, and your curios. So kind of proof of travel and adventure and questionable duty-free purchasing.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so that's what a plea for social media produces when all of your contacts come from the trade. Okay, so just to turn that into data, sweet liqueurs or dessert drinks, so the Baileys, the single banana liqueur from the Caribbean, the avocat, they represented 40% of the cupboard.
Wow.
Whiskey, scotch and bourbon, another 25%.
Okay, and then the brandy, gin, vodka accounted for about 20%, and then the souvenir outliers for about 15%.
Yes, and of course these numbers don't add up to 100% because people had more than one category.
Okay, you're off to my job again as the resident researcher here, Felicity. So I'm really interested in is why did people have these bottles in the first place? Why are they all sitting there? Where did they come from?
Gifting or re-gifting account for 35%, travel souvenirs for 25%, lockdown cocktail phase came in at 15%, what we might call relics about 10%, and then the whiskey and gin enthusiasts to go shopping for themselves account for about 15%. Mm-hmm. But I want to emphasise that nearly all of these results come from people who work in some capacity with alcohol.
Yeah. Well, Felicity, I couldn't just sit back and let you claim all the primary research glory. So I went to my own friends, so non-industry folk, to see what was in their cupboards.
What are you doing hanging around with non-industry folk, really?
Okay. Well, yes.
Is this a work of anthropology or charity or something?
Exactly. Ethnography at its best.
Yeah.
So same caveat, not representative, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But let's take some examples. So Sarah, she said she's got Metaxa, a gift from 5 years ago, still hanging around, a forgotten bottle of cherry brandy that she only remembered once she started rummaging after my question, a clean R0 alcohol spirit she admits was a nice idea, but now says unimpressive. And then along with her Jägermeister, something called pineapple grenade.
Pineapple grenade? What on earth is that?
Well, I did have to look it up because I didn't know either. So a pineapple-flavoured spiced rum, get this, 65% ABV. Gosh. So it's marketed as blow the doors off rum. Sweet, boozy, sugary, the kind of novelty that you buy for shots and then abandon.
Do you know, it's funny, when we were cleaning out the Australian cupboard, we found a different brand of spiced rum and I tried it and it was just awful.
Oh, okay. So then there's Caroline, who reports that her husband has been building a backup drinks cupboard. So she quite reasonably points out that they could have just enjoyed the excess stuff, which include champagne, saved on joinery, his time, and drunk champagne all month instead, which I think is the best argument for decluttering I've ever heard.
Can I just clarify this? Mm-hmm. So this guy is building an additional drinks cupboard for the stuff that doesn't fit in the primary cupboard. And so he's spending time and money instead of, like, you know, just drinking it.
Yep, correct. And we'll get into more about why we hold on to stuff, including our drinks, and why so many of us insist on saving them for best in a moment. But finally, let me share Claire's story. So she has a bottle of Chinese plum dessert wine sitting there, which she says has been there for about 5 years, she reckons, and was the relic of a classic case of Christmas fair overexcitement. She said, to the point you were just making about kind of sediment and how long do these drinks last, she said it looks like it's full of sediment. But she said she thinks that's nature's way of telling her not to drink it. But her best story, a bottle of Midori gifted by visiting friends that lasted about 15 years with only one shot gone before finally being thrown out.
All right. So I think at this point we need to showcase your behavioural science expertise, Luli. Why? I understand why people buy this stuff on impulse, but why is everybody keeping it?
Okay. Yeah. But before I get into this, what did you learn about why the LinkedIn community had so many bottles? Because we've been talking about this, you know, for anything from 5 to 30 to 40 bottles. So yes, members of the trade, but presumably they should have enough knowledge to know what they're likely to drink or indeed not likely
to
drink.
Well, it's interesting because as with so many other social questions, the answer is really about the pandemic. People said that the lockdown revived cocktail culture and that's why they're now stuck with small bottles of spirits and bitters and the leftover ingredients. And I think this is something that the media should have reported on. The other way they were talking about sourdough culture. Exactly. There was this whole other thing going on.
Yeah, but that I guess that can't be the only reason.
Well, the other thing is the gift economy. So a lot of these bottles were presents or apparently sneaky re-gifts. And it turns out that spirits just circulate endlessly. Mm. So that bottle of Avocat will probably become an heirloom that somebody's kids will feel obligated to cut round to Christmas parties. Okay, back to you, Luli.
Okay, so as I said earlier, as a researcher, I'm equally interested in why we don't get rid of them. So I've come up with one of my frameworks for Steve. You know, we love a framework. So five psychological effects as to why we keep hold of this stuff.
Okay. I will jump in and say, I bet you some of this is about what the spirits say about your own life. So, you know, what you're drinking at university or party spirits, the schnapps, the miserable mistakes with Corne de Month, some period of creative cocktail enthusiasm like Kahlua, and then maybe a few sort of luxury holdouts like champagne or malt whiskey.
Exactly. So spot on. So the first effect is known as the endowment effect. So once we own something, we attach sort of irrational value to it as if it's part of our own story, as you were just saying. So Richard Thaler, so he's one of my behavioral economic heroes, first described this back in 1980.
Oh God, so this explains some of the junk I've got collecting dust.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jack Kanetch, if I've pronounced that correctly, excuse me if I haven't, later tested this in 1989. So he ran an experiment. He gave participants, so half of the participants mugs and half chocolate bars of equal value, and then offered everyone the chance to swap. So if people had valued both equally, about half should have traded. But in reality, around 90% of those people kept either the mug or the chocolate, whichever one they'd been given.
Okay, so that surprises me for two reasons. One is that a mug that is equivalent to chocolate must be a terrible mug. And secondly, I thought everyone would ditch the mugs for the other reason, which is so they can grab the chocolate.
Exactly, but they don't, because it just is demonstrating this endowment effect. Basically, just owning something makes people cling on to it, even when the alternative, as you've said, chocolate, potentially is good or better.
Yeah, and I guess that gets even stronger if it's a gift from someone you value. So not only do you want to hang on to it because you now own it, but you actually feel guilty if you try and get rid of it.
Yeah, exactly. So I have a perfect endowment effect moment on holiday recently. So I was on holiday with friends and they had been given a bottle of vodka. And not being vodka drinkers, they bought it with them and re-gifted it with full transparency. They did.
Now, let me guess, you're not a big vodka household either. So did you re-gift it, Luli?
No. So we were on holiday with the friends. We had this full bottle of vodka. And due to the endowment effect, none of us wanted to throw the vodka away, even though it was free to them in the first place and then free to us as the second re-gift. So we decided to do a cocktail making challenge where each of us had to make a cocktail using only ingredients we could find in the villa.
Okay, that sounds really dangerous.
It was really fun. So while we were using up things like a dusty bottle of creme de cassis, another relic from the back of the cupboard in the villa, and a rather questionably old bottle of Cava, I leant really hard into the challenge, Felicity.
God, not that you're competitive or anything. All right, what did you make?
So I made a honey and rosemary vodka sour with egg white.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I even made my own rosemary and honey simple syrup to go with it from scratch.
Look at you. Oh my goodness.
Collected rosemary from the garden because it was in the villa. Anyway. So I used egg white, which I've drunk cocktails clearly using egg white before, but not made one. So it felt really odd tipping raw egg white into the cocktail shaker. But the result was amazing. And needless to say, Felicity, I won.
Oh, of course you didn't. Knowing you, you probably made cakes from the yolks that were left over or something. All right. So you got rid of the vodka and you had the satisfaction of winning all at the same time.
I did. So the second effect, psychological effect we can talk about is the sunk cost fallacy.
Oh, my wardrobe is a homage to the sunk cost fallacy.
Yeah. So once we've invested time or money or effort, we feel compelled to stick with it, even when it no longer makes sense. So rationally, these costs are gone, sunk costs, literally. But psychologically, walking away feels like admitting defeat. So this was the term for sunk cost fallacy was first coined by Arkas and Bloomer in 1985.
Yeah, it's a brilliant insight. And we do it all the time. You know, it was like the other night, I was at a restaurant. I had this awful, awful, awful food, but I sort of felt compelled to finish it because I knew I was going to have to pay for it.
Yeah, exactly. Which means in terms of our drinks, we can't throw out that half bottle of Maduri or whatever it is because we spent good money on it. And that purchase, the purchase years and years ago still exerts power on us today, even though that's not real. It's sunk cost.
Yeah. And I will say the sunk cost fallacy is one of the most dangerous forces in business where people continue down a path to disaster because they feel they've invested so much they can't pull out.
Yeah, exactly. And at a small level, you pay the price of cluttered cupboards, but there's a third effect that comes into play here as well.
Let me guess. Are you talking about the power of nostalgia?
Yes, in part. So that's part of it. But actually, what I was going to say was the third effect is about identity signaling and social display.
Oh, okay. You mean that's why we have the closed doors of the cupboards? Because people in the trade don't want to display their limoncello.
Or in fact, they do, because we got lots of people from the trade who showed us their bottles of limoncello featuring in their cupboards. But what we did see, there was kind of quite an interesting gender difference in the responses that we got. Again, caveat, small sample size. But in the women's list, it was skewed more towards liqueurs, dessert wines, and sentimental bottles that they talked about for cooking or a gift from a friend or a holiday impulse buy.
Yeah, though I will say that might also represent the gifts that people give women. But I will also add that we did see the men's list were, first of all, more heavily skewed towards whiskey, gin, rum and brandy, which could also be the gift economy. Yeah. But they also showed a pride in curation or control. Like they talked about, you know, my library of gin, my kids' inheritance and so on.
Yeah, and that's where there's an element of what's called social display value, or is also termed identity fantasy.
So that's like the bar cart where you put the bottles on display to signal, you know, how much status and taste and money you've got to spend on spirits, even if nobody actually drinks them.
Yeah, my famous whiskey bar could come under that category, although we do drink it as well. But examples of identity fantasy, so we hold onto bottles not for their use, but for the selves they allow us to imagine to be. So the connoisseur, as you were saying, the general host, the sentimental traveller.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that the liquor cabinet functions a lot like my wardrobe, where we hang on to old clothes or clothes we bought by mistake or clothes that are too small because our future self is going to be slender enough to make them chic.
Yes, and that's the perfect lead into effect number four, which is about magical thinking and our future selves. So this is the part of our brain that's convinced we need to hang on to the creme de menthe, or maybe not in your case, because there's a chance of a cocktail party in our futures.
Yes, public service announcement. Listeners, that day will never come. You need to abandon the condom off.
Okay. So they won't, Felicity, because everyone is imagining a future self, a host, a mixologist, an all-round entertainer, which sort of justifies keeping it. Both magical thinking and idealized future self are examples of this identity fantasy.
Okay, so that brings us to the fifth and final effect, saving things for best. Why do we do that?
Okay, so this is known in psychology circles as sacralization.
Okay, you're going to have to explain this one. What is sacralization?
Okay. So it comes from the Latin root sacrum, so meaning holy or sacred. So sacralization, so it means we make something sacred. So not literally in the religious sense of the word, but more metaphorically. So we elevate an ordinary object so it feels untouchable or it has more symbolism.
Like the good china.
Yeah, exactly. So spurred on by this episode, I also cleared out actually a wine rack. And what did I find hiding at the back? A grower champagne from 1995, which I think was left over from our wedding.
Lily, how big is your wine rack that you could overlook a grower champagne? How big is it? Now confess.
That's private okay. Information.
All right, so tell us, what did you do with this bottle?
Well, unlike all the five such psychological effects we've been talking about, I actually chilled it and opened it. I thought, I'm not going to just leave it. I'm not going to put it back in the cupboard like you did. I'm actually going to try it.
I see. Yeah. Okay. What did you discover?
Let's just say it was a fully toasted biscuit flavour, but fascinating. But that's the point, that bottles like that become sacralised. So the bottle stops just being wine, or in this case, champagne, and it kind of moves to become elevated to the wedding champagne.
So the symbol becomes more important than the pleasure of it.
Exactly. So we overvalue the bottle as a symbol and actually undervalue the joy of actually drinking it. So perhaps that's what happened, Felicity, with your unopened gift of the Canadian ice wine. So the people that you gave it to maybe sacralized it because of the value they hold to, or they held you in. So they actually kind of valued that more than the pleasure of drinking it.
I would so like to think that, Lily. I would really do. But I think it was more like, get it out of sight, out of mind. We'll drink it maybe sometime.
I was trying to make you feel good there for the yeah, gift
very
you
much.
Found.
All right. So I guess we've covered not just what people are keeping, but why. And now we should encourage people to clear them out, because that's a lot of dead weight hanging around, not just in terms of bottles, but psychological dead weight as well.
Yeah. Well, my own approach is to try and use them up for cocktails or combine them, as you referred to earlier, into my annual Christmas tree theme and party. And of course, our new venture that we're going to do, the Festival of the Drinks Cabinet, Felicity.
Well, I know that you're good at the whole cocktail thing, but I would actually have no idea how to mix any without a recipe book, and they all look complicated.
It's actually not that hard. So as I learnt on my WSET level one in spirits, as I said before, no effort spared in my dedication to this podcast. The core idea behind most cocktails is the balance of four core elements. So Felicity, even you can make cocktails using this. So ready? Strong is the first element. So that's spirit base, which is the main alcoholic component. Second is the weak, so the dilution or the lengthener. That balances the strength. So think in the form of ice melt, soda, tonic, juice. Third is the sour, the acid, which provides the freshness and structure. So think here lemon, lime, grapefruit. And finally, the sweet, the sugar, which balances the acidity and the bitterness. So simple syrup, liqueur, honey, agave. So if you use that framework, you get something, you know, take one of my favorites, whiskey sour. So the whiskey is the strong, the lemon is the sour, the sugar is the sweet, and the ice is the weak or dilution. There you go.
Or you could just go to Lidl and get gin and tonic in a can like I do.
Oh, no. That is so cheating, Felicity. But, back to the self-confessed, a genius idea I've had that we mentioned earlier. What should we actually do with all of these half-opened and unopened bottles? As I said, we can start the new best festival ever, the Festival of the Drinks Cabinet.
Well, I love the idea, but I need to know more about how you're planning to actually do it.
Okay. It works like this, Felicity. Everyone comes to the festival, brings along their forgotten bottles, the Maduras, the Avoca, the Metaxa. We hire brilliant bartenders and mixologists to turn the whole lot into cocktails for one glorious night. So the bottles finally get used, people have a blast, the cupboards everywhere are liberated. Win, win, win.
Yeah, apart from this, just a couple of obvious issues, like health and safety for one. So, you know, half-drunk bottles of mysterious origin don't exactly scream hygiene. And don't forget, judging by just our social media answers, that would be a lot of alcohol. We'd need a big space to pack enough people in.
Okay, so health and safety, clearly aside, it would still be brilliant. Okay, not just for our cupboards, but for the spirits producers too, because then the likelihood is once all the bottles are gone, people will restock with something fresher and probably, maybe, even of better quality.
Actually, this sounds like my retirement plan is sorted. If everybody brings the drinks, the biggest cost is taken care of.
Exactly, and from a behavioural science perspective, it's perfect. So the sunk cost fallacy gets resolved because the bottles aren't wasted, they're consumed. The endowment effect gets neutralised because the emotional symbolic bottles are repurposed and shared into fun. And even the identity signalling flips. Instead of hoarding bottles to show who we are, we're collectively reinventing them.
Yes, and then because nature abhors a vacuum, people would feel like they had to fill up the empty cabinet space again. So it'd be a big win for the alcohol companies. Yeah. So what you're suggesting is a mass decluttering ritual. Out with the old bottles, in with clean cupboards and refreshed identities.
Exactly, a reset for our cupboards and our psyches. Now all we need is the venue, a few hundred forgotten bottles, and bartenders brave enough to face 30-year-old Creme de Menthe. I'd say that was a proper solve for this week's question, Felicity.
Yes, and listeners, if you've got a venue of this size in a major metropolitan location and you're willing to give it for free and to turn up and make cocktails and clean up after us, please get in touch at aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com and also don't forget to send us your questions, which we'll do our best to solve.
And we hope to see you all at the Festival of the Drinks Cabinet. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send us any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche, the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.